Good morning, everyone. It's Sunday, March 1st, and the start of the 13th week of war for the United States. To report on the war, we're going to call in our reporters from abroad. So first, go ahead, London.
This is London. John McVain speaking. About an hour ago, the Dutch government in London issued an official statement by the Dutch headquarters at Batavia. The statement announced that the Japanese have landed at 3 points in Java. Allied naval forces opposed one of the landing fleets, and Allied air forces attacked both the other landing fleets throughout the night. Dutch and American submarines came into action against the enemy naval forces and transports. Dutch army units are said to be offering fierce resistance at the 3 points where the enemy landed. The oil field and refineries near Jappo were demolished last night to prevent them falling into the hands of the Japanese. Dispatches from Java reaching London estimate unofficially the number of Japanese actually landed as somewhere between a few thousand and four divisions. This report says a heavy Japanese cruiser was sunk. Two cruisers seriously damaged, while three destroyers were left burning. The Allies lost three cruisers and one destroyer, all Dutch, which were sunk. The British parachute raid on the coast of German-occupied France has acted as a tonic to the British. It's being emphasized, of course, that the raid wasn't any tremendous operation. But it's pleased everyone to think that the services can organize and carry out successfully a raid against the German forces that are in the position that most threatens Britain itself. The Sunday Express says, even if it isn't possible to answer Litvinov's appeal for a second front, Britain can surely use her commando force as it was meant to be used. The Sunday Express goes on, we can raid constantly at widely separated points of a long coastline. We can keep the Germans on the jump. We can give them both the jitters and the works. And the Express adds, we can thus draw off large German forces which would otherwise be at Russia's throat. Follow Russia's grand example in total warfare and give ourselves new heart. Let us have done with disheartened defense. Let us plunge wherever the smallest chance is offered to the attack. Another commentator in Reynolds News says Britain's need is for fearless, straightforward criticism in Parliament and Whitehall. The hard, realistic thinking that will produce a counter-strategy as daring and successful as Hitler's. The paper calls the parachutists' raid a pointer to effective action and says, as one of a series of simultaneous blows, the combined operations raid can pay rich dividends. A British eyewitness of part of the operation says the parachutists' faces were blackened even to the teeth. The parachutists themselves were Scotchmen, and the men who protected the landing craft in the operation were London Cockneys and men from an English county regiment. One of the parachute leaders was a 21-year-old ex-newspaper man. The commander of the men who landed by boat was a former copy reader on the London paper. Factory workers, shipyard workers, professional football players, artists, and stockbrokers took part in the raid. One of the parachutists said the Germans had a whole armored division 50 miles away, and just before they left, the parachutists had seen a column of headlights coming toward the beach. A couple of days ago, the British Labour Party issued a pamphlet that cost the equivalent of a nickel. It's called The Old World and the New Society, and it sums up British Labour's ideas on what kind of a world should come out of the war and what should be done now to achieve it. The report has been unanimously adopted by the Executive Council of the party. It's been issued at a time when the British working people are groping for concrete ideas, for some assurance that their lives will be fuller and more promising after this war than during the pre-war days. The workers of many factories have from time to time met and sent delegates to the Labour Ministry or some other government ministry or to Labour Party headquarters. They've complained not about wages and hours, but about inefficiency. They've said their effort wasn't being used at 100% efficiency because of management's failure to organize work on the most modern lines. The workers have said, too, that they want to feel that the effort they're making now will be used for the good of the many, not the profits of the few. The Labour report asserts that the basis of democracy must be planned production for community use. It says that to secure the fulfillment of the four freedoms, Britain must organize to provide things like full employment, better social services, and maintain wartime controls over industry and agriculture to avoid the same sort of scramble for profits as that which followed the last war. The significance of the report is that it's the first publicized attempt to chart the course of the post-war world. The first attempt to give a concrete response to the worries of the ordinary English working man and the English Tommy when he wonders what kind of a life he'll have to look forward to when the war is ended. This is John McVain in London, returning you to New York.
And from the New York newsroom, here's a brief news story. Cairo, Egypt. A small enemy column was successfully engaged by British artillery in the desert north, or rather of North Africa, east of El Mekili, according to the British. There was considerable patrol activity in which the Air Force gave support, according to the communique. Next now, news from our allies in the Pacific, brought to us through the newsroom in San Francisco.
We are unable to contact Sydney, Australia this morning. However, from our San Francisco newsrooms, we bring you the headlines of the Pacific fighting. 16 Japanese bombers and fighters attacked Port Moresby yesterday and caused some damage, the high command reported today. RAAF planes attempted to attack a Jap convoy off Kupang, but were intercepted by enemy fighters, the communique said. However, all planes returned safely to their bases. Planes of the RAAF bombed the runway of the airfield as Gasmata, New Britain, last night, the high command added. Now here are further details from the fighting in Batavia. The long-expected battle for Java raged bitterly today along the northern and western shores of that island stronghold, heart of the Netherlands East Indies, after an historic sea battle in which Dutch warships sacrificed themselves in a vain attempt to keep the invaders from their precious land. The Dutch reported that at least 10 Japanese warships and transports had been sunk or damaged in sea and air action since Friday, but acknowledged the loss of two cruisers and a destroyer. Reuters news agency even upped those figures. 15 Japanese transports have been sunk or set on fire, while six others have been seriously damaged in the last 24 hours in the battle for Java. The news agency reported the Japanese succeeded in getting something like 50 transports to Java. It was not known how many Japanese troops landed, but unofficial estimates varied between a few thousand and four divisions of between 60 and 100,000 men. The Dutch were said in previous reports to have 100,000 soldiers under arms in Java, plus the British, Australian, and United States soldiers who have reached the island since the Japanese threat grew acute. The fighting was in thunderous progress on land, at sea, and in the air, with the Dutch, United States, and British troops putting up an all-out defense of the Allied resistance in the Southwest Pacific. The Netherlands East Indies High Command officially reported heavy losses were inflicted in the sea battle and on the landing parties, but the same report acknowledged Japanese landings at three key points. Allied warplanes, it was reported, had exacted the following toll of the invasion fleet up to late afternoon. One transport sunk, one warship blown up, one ship set on fire, and one ship damaged by a bomb hit. The terrific price the Allied fleet paid and levied in the gallant attempt to keep the Japanese transport from landing their troops on the Java beaches was told in a long NEI communique summing up. It listed the following results. Japanese losses, one heavy cruiser sunk, one 8-inch gun cruiser badly damaged, one Mogami-class cruiser on fire or sinking, three destroyers left burning or sinking, and the Dutch losses as follows. Two cruisers sunk, apparently torpedoed in night fighting, one destroyer blown up, one cruiser damaged, and the communique said United States and Dutch submarines had gone into action against the Japanese invasion fleet, but that results of their attacks had not been ascertained at this time. Following the summation in a special communique, the regular Dutch communique outlined the invasion situation and said that a Dutch destroyer engaged in an uneven battle with two Japanese cruisers fought to an end when it was beached in a sinking condition. The destroyer had taken part in the defense by Dutch and United States naval forces against the main landing of the Japanese, while two other invasion fleets were attacked throughout the night by the air forces. Netherlands bombing attacks are still continuing, the communique said, adding that Dutch and United States submarines also came into action against enemy naval forces and transports, which are now attacking Java. Reports about the results have not yet been received. The action is being continued, said the regular communique. As for the battle in Burma, the last reports from London said that the Japanese are gathering strength in Burma for an onslaught against British troops west of the Sitang River, and the situation at this time is very serious. Now, news of the events from home, reported by the newsroom in Washington.
The court-martial, which has been ordered for Rear Admiral Husband E. Kimmel and Major General Walter C. Short, is still the main topic of discussion in Washington. However, capital observers generally do not believe that the two officers who were in command at Pearl Harbor when the Japanese delivered their stab in the back will be brought to trial until after the war. Kimmel and Short, as you know, are charged with dereliction of duty, the same charge which was leveled against them by the Pearl Harbor Investigating Commission under Supreme Court Justice Roberts. However, in ordering the officers held for court-martial proceedings yesterday, Secretaries Knox and Stimson both said that the trials would not be held until such time as the public interest and safety would permit. This is taken in Washington to mean after the conclusion of the war. In the meantime, both men will be retired on salaries of $6,000 a year each, pending the court's martial. This is three-quarters of their base pay while on the active list. Should the military courts which try them so decide, they may reduce both of the officers in rank, and thereby cut their retirement pay accordingly. Should the trials be delayed until the war's end, the move will not be without precedent. In several cases of lesser nature during World War I, court-martial proceedings were delayed until after the conflict ended. On Capitol Hill, meanwhile, farm bloc senators have decided to change their strategy in the campaign to prevent the government from selling surplus stocks below parity. A special seven-man committee, headed by Alabama Senator John Bankhead, will call on the president tomorrow afternoon in an effort to heal the breach between the White House and the agricultural group. The chief executive has persistently opposed higher farm prices, and tomorrow's meeting is likely to be anything but calm. The seven-man committee, a special appointed group of the Senate Agriculture Committee, was named yesterday after some members of the farm bloc had urged that an effort be made to avoid a continuing fight with the White House. These members contend that such a battle will only promote disunity. At the same time, it's being predicted on Capitol Hill that Senator Thomas, Democrat of Oklahoma, will abandon his attempt to attach a parity price rider to the $32 billion war appropriation bill. Mr. Roosevelt has already denounced such omnibus legislation in vigorous terms. Elsewhere in Washington, William L. Batt, Director of Materials for the War Production Board, gives Lend-Lease the credit for keeping airplane engine and propeller production from lagging 2 years behind. Mr. Batt says that the $13 billion which has been appropriated under the Lend-Lease Act so far has expanded our capacity for making planes and tanks, munitions and ships. And he adds, these funds have also served to create new industries which are now making vital supplies both for our own forces and those of our allies. And the War Department has suggested a way in which the town fathers throughout the nation can make a real contribution to the war effort. The department has made the suggestion that all the German cannon which were captured during the First World War and now grace most of the courthouse lawns in the nation should be turned over to junk dealers for scrap. The general idea seems to be to throw back at the Axis a bit of its own scrap, sort of a retaliation for the American scrap which was formerly sold to the Axis and is now being thrown back at us. Further, the War Department points out that the sale of the cannon to the junk dealers would mean more money to purchase defense bonds and stamps. And that's all from the nation's capital.
And there, ladies and gentlemen, you have the news from at home and abroad. This morning you heard reports from the news from London by John McBean. And may we leave you now with this reminder that for the latest news, please keep tuned to this station.
This is the National Broadcasting Company.